and for the holiday. We are giving thanks for the input our guests and listeners have given us all year long. We look back at some of the memorable interviews and conversations we've had. One segment that got a huge amount of reaction on our website was about the notion of beauty. We asked Stanford University Law Professor Deborah Rohde about whether the law should be involved in preventing discrimination on the basis of appearance or good looks. Rohde is the author of the book, The Beauty Bias, The Injustice of Appearance in Life and Law. So you describe in your book this, what I thought of as relatively condescending and humiliating process by which they were trying to, the university was trying to manage your appearance for some television cameras. And that made you think more about whether or not the law should protect you from that.
Well, ironically enough, it wasn't the university. It was the American Bar Association's Commission on Women in the Profession, which is, of course, designed to advance women in the profession, but whose media experts thought that I needed a personal shopper, makeup artist, and hairstylist for the annual luncheon. And, of course, they were willing to pay for it, although I declined that. If you're my age and you can't manage your own mascara, you should pay for it yourself. But,
well, you know, but people seek this thing out when they go on that show, What Not to Wear. They think of that as a good thing. But in your particular case, to having these people coming over and going through your closet and kind of tossing everything out as frumpy seemed to me really insulting.
Well, looks are really the last bastion of acceptable bigotry in this culture.
Can the law redress that?
Well, six jurisdictions do have statutes which ban appearance discrimination in some form. And contrary to critics' worry, they haven't produced a barrage of loony litigation. You know, they have relatively little enforcement activity, in part because it's the costs, as you might imagine, of bringing these suits are too high, both financially and psychologically. But they do curb the worst abuses. They provide some deterrent against them. And most importantly, they get people talking about what's fair and what's not fair in the workplace. And I think it's the publicity surrounding some of the cases that has produced the best results.
I find it fascinating in your book. You make some very strong cases for the fact that appearance should be considered a form of sexism in many cases, because women suffer from this kind of discrimination more than men, but that it also can be life-threatening. I mean, you go into the estimated 8 million Americans who are suffering from eating disorders, 7 million women, only 1 million men. You say this is a healthcare concern as well.
Well, it is. And, you know, women are 90% of the consumers of cosmetic surgery, which is the fastest growing specialty. And that's not a benign procedure either. But, you know, even some of the petty indignities get in the way of women's advancement, both literally and figuratively. Stiletto heels are a big problem. 80% of women have foot or back problems, most of which are related to heels that have nothing to do with being functional footwear. And, you know, if men can manage to be sexy without their shoes, why can't women?
Well, but, that's a point
but
I love.
If there is a statistical, an overwhelming statistical likelihood that people are going to make decisions, whether they're compelled or not, to make their looks better, even if it, you know, tortures their feet, isn't there a community standards argument here that the law is supposed to reflect that as well as redress and create a kind of equal playing field regardless of looks?
Well, sure. And I'm all for ordinances which, like the ones we have, build in some provisions for employers to have reasonable grooming codes that promote hygiene and, you know, standards that are normal in the industry. What I don't like are the things like the casino requirements that make Borgata babes have hourglass figures and requirements that bartenders have to have makeup and their hair teased and styled, whereas their male counterparts only have to have clean fingernails. We're seeing it play out a bit in the recent Elena Kagan nomination. I mean, you get these comments like, why do Janet Napolitano and Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan all look like linebackers for the New York Jets, says, you know, one of the editors of Human Events Com, which is, you know, where my question is, why do these women have to put up with these comments? And even more to the point, what makes our culture think that commentators like talk show host Michael Savage feel entitled to comment that Kagan looks like she belongs in a kosher deli?
Well, the other thing is that they look more like real people than the people on TV.
Well, right. And attractiveness isn't a qualification for judicial office. I mean, not all the male justices are eye candy, but their confirmations didn't trigger this kind of ridicule. And so I think sort of cultural protests against this kind of demeaning form of prejudice are really part of the answer, and in the long run, more effective than a legal strategy, although they can work in tandem with it.
So, you know, I have to ask you, if your own career is an argument against that, I mean, you are very successful. And you yourself say that you dress in a frumpy way. Do you think you could have gone further or been paid more had you dressed more in line with what society thinks of for a woman?
Well, I'm not a poster child for this by any means. I mean, I'm in a very forgiving profession, academia. But I think a lot of women don't have that same luxury, and we don't want women who are in the public eye all to have to conform to a much higher standard than men. I mean, men at least can gray with gravitas, whereas women, you just really don't see them over a certain age unless they've had substantial work done. So I think we have to look closely at the kind of social images and cultural standards that we're projecting. And it's kind of a telling reflection of our cultural preoccupations that Sarah Palin's campaign paid more for makeup artists than her foreign policy advisor.
Deborah Rohde talking about her book, The Beauty Bias. I'm actually back here with Takeaway Digital Editor Jim Colgan. And the reason that you're here is because we got an overwhelming response from our listeners, right?
That's right. That was one of the main reasons why we replayed that, because of all the interest that it's still generating actually online and on Facebook. And here are a couple of some of the things we got. Shauna was one of the many who reacted. She said, I personally think that personal appearance or beauty is a relative term. That was in answer to the question, should you be legislating this? Should the law protect people who are not attractive? She said, who determines the standard? I am a fat person and work in a business casual environment, but I'm also broke because of the recent economy. And but ridiculous, says Kate from Washington, D.C. How would you define ugliness or beauty? Would you now let the courts decide what's acceptable? She said. And I'll leave you with one from Marissa from Brooklyn, New York, who invoked author Kurt Vonnegut.
To make it a legal responsibility to protect the unattractive brings to mind Kurt Vonnegut's short story, Harrison Bergeron, where in order to compel equality, the beautiful are masked, the graceful are weighed down, and the thought processes of the intelligent are controlled by microchip.
So listeners weighing in on the question, should the law protect people who are not attractive? And you can still weigh in at 877-8MYTAKE or online at thetakeaway.org.
Should we have a law? I mean, but then how do you define an attractive? That's the rub, isn't it?
Big question.
Many people would say Kurt Vonnegut may fit in that category. And yet, great mind.
Mm-hmm.